Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you so much for joining Evie Williamson with the Art of Health and Wellness. I'm so glad you're here today. I hope everybody's doing well. I hope everybody's staying safe, and I'm hoping that everybody's being real creative. WRUU 107.5 Savannah, the real sound of Savannah, 107.5 FM, and WRUU Community Radio with Global Soul. And this afternoon, we have a very, very special guest with the Art of Health and Wellness. And of course, the Art of Health and Wellness, our goal is educate, engage, and entertain through the 8 different components, including emotional, environmental, financial, intellectual, occupational, physical, social, and spiritual wellness. Okay, so our guest today, I'm proud to say, is a friend, an esteemed physician in the Southeast and all over the country, Dr. Millard James Collier Jr., MD, FAAFP, which means Fellow of American Academy of Family Physicians. I know you're impressed by that, Dr.
I am very impressed. That.
Yeah, I did a little research, but we're going to go into his bio. MJ Collier Jr., MD, Fellow American Academy of Family Physicians, currently serves as President, CEO of Atlanta West Primary Care Associates. In the position of Medical Director, he coordinates primary health care services for men, women, and children. Dr. Collier received his undergraduate education at Morehouse College in 1979 in Atlanta, and his medical degree from Medical College of Georgia in Augusta. His residency training was at Morehouse School of Medicine, serving his final years as chief resident. Dr. Collier became a fellow of the American Academy of Family Physicians in 2002. Dr. Collier currently serves as a board chairman and immediate past president of the Georgia State Medical Association, GSMA. He serves on the board of directors for the Heritage Fund of Atlanta Medical Association and is the chairman of the Community Services Committee of Atlanta Medical Association. He has also served as a board chairman and president of the Atlanta Medical Association, the Georgia Academy of Family Physicians, and close to my heart, the 100 Black Men of America South Metro Chapter. Dr. Collier serves as an on-air personality host of the Your Health is Important radio talk show on WYZE 1480 AM. Atlanta's own hip-hop doc, hoo-hoo, can be heard on WVEEV 103 FM, The Ryan Cameron Show, and the syndicated The Ricky Smiley Show, heard locally on Hot 107.9 FM. For all you Atlanta folks, shout out to my old hometown folks. In 1997, Dr. Collier was appointed as chief ring physician for boxing in the state of Georgia and continues to serve ringside at all professional boxing events. This is my favorite part. As a native of Atlanta, Dr. Collier is married to the most wonderful Dolores Perez Collier and the father of 5 children, count them 5, folks.
5.
Carla Millard III, better known as C3, Victoria, Catherine, and Miles. Oh my God, those last two, I remember when they were born. Oh my God, time flies. Dr. Collier, hi, welcome to my show. Thank you, Evie,
for having me on your health and wellness show. It is such a pleasure when we happened to talk and you told me that you were doing radio now. I was just, you know, so happy to be a part of your show and looking forward to your Savannah audience and anyone else who tunes in to get this information.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, we're very glad to have you here, and I just want to let the listeners know, in order to be a fellow with the American Academy of Family Physicians, the physician must complete a detailed list of requirements and be selected by the AAFP. The degree of fellow recognized AAFP members who has distinguished themselves amongst their colleagues as well as their communities. By advancement of American healthcare through medical and educational research. So I just want to let everybody know, this has been my family physician for a long, long time, 2 generations in my family. Not only that, like I said, a very, very, very dear friend. And I'm so honored and glad to have you here today. So let's get down to our little list of questions, okay? And then also, I also want to do a disclaimer that please consult a licensed medical a physician about any health and wellness advice given on this show. Okay. All right. So now we got all our disclaimers out of the way, all the accolades and all the medical terminology out of the way. Let's get down to it. Dr. Collier, what is internal medicine?
Okay. Internal medicine is the primary care medical services for adult men and women. So that means you know, as a family physician, I take care of men, I take care of women, and I take care of children. So I can see everybody and I do everything.
Okay. All right. So why did you choose internal medicine?
Well, I chose internal medicine because the disease processes that disproportionately affect the African-American community, such as high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, the metabolic syndrome, obesity, all things that I can address. I have friends and family members that were continuously and constantly seeking medical advice. And I realized that if I limited myself, and especially because I was seriously considering one psychiatry and or OBGYN, but that would have really limited who I could see. And so I wanted to keep my practice diverse. And that was one of the benefits of training at the Moir School of Medicine at the time at Southwest Community Hospital.
Mm-hmm. Well, that leads right into my next question about the disparaging difference between African-American health and African-American healthcare versus others. Can you kind of go over that a little bit?
Yes. Disparities in healthcare have been around for as long as there have been healthcare. It was noted and quoted by Reverend Martin Luther King, as he said, you know, the healthcare disparities were a sin, and that, you know, that was one of the biggest problems. It wasn't just racism, but it was the inability for people of color to obtain the same type of healthcare services that the majority population could get. A simple and easy thing. If an African-American or a person of color goes to the emergency room and they're having severe pain and they present and say, I'm hurting, I hurt my back or something to that nature, it will be looked upon in a negative way usually, that they're drug seeking or having some issues, and rarely are they treated with the same types of pain medications and given the same type of pain relief as a Caucasian patient who will present with the exact same symptoms.
I don't mean to cut you off, but that is so disturbing.
Yeah, that's very disturbing. And again, it's a cultural phenomenon. When people, you know, you have to look at it from this perspective. People know and associate with the people their family members and the people that they know and people that live in their neighborhood. So if you have not been exposed to minorities, and the only images that you have gotten are the negative images that are portrayed in media, on the news every night, and even in, you know, movies and on television, et cetera, there's a different perspective given. And so oftentimes it's just a simple matter of really being diverse and spending quality time with people of other races so that you get to know them and you find out, wait a minute, that's not the way these people are at all. But it's not just, you know, let's say I just use drugs because it's the easiest for a lot of people, they can understand that. But let's say if a person goes in with chest pain, a Caucasian male will obtain the $1 million workup, as we say. He'll go to the hospital and get every diagnostic test that's known to man, almost regardless of his ability to pay or whether he has insurance or not. But for people of color, oftentimes they get what I call the wallet biopsy. And if they get the wallet biopsy and it comes up, say they don't have insurance or they're underinsured. Means they have insurance, but the insurance doesn't cover a lot of things, then oftentimes their care is mediated by what's covered and versus what's not covered. So that's where we are with that. And, so disparities continue to be a problem. This coronavirus epidemic and pandemic has demonstrated this, in an acute manner, and letting people understand who maybe didn't have an understanding of what the disparities are in the sea. They're still talking about it. It's newsworthy now on CNN for the last 3 days. They have spoken about, again, African Americans being disproportionately. They are 80% of the people that are admitted to the hospital. They are more than 50% of the people that have died from the coronavirus, and yet they're, you know, less than 30% of the population in most areas. So, you know, the numbers aren't adding up, as they say.
So you being a healthcare professional on the front line, definitely with the practice, seeing it every day, having patients, that sort of thing, even though I know the answer to this question, mm-hmm. why do you think that there is that pandemic one is hitting us so hard as in a community, and what can we do as a community to help bridge that divide?
Oh, great question, EL. One, you look at the medical predisposition. They talk about predisposing conditions, obesity being one, high blood pressure being the other, type 2 diabetes being the third, high cholesterol, general poor health, smoking, use of alcohol, sometimes disproportionate amounts. Dr. Kaya advocates drinking alcohol, 2 cocktails a day minimum, but some people drink to excess, so it can be a problem. So you look at it from the medical perspective, you're just not as healthy a patient population. But let's look at the social determinants of health. Oftentimes, African-Americans are on the front lines. They are on the jobs that are considered, what's the term they're using now, dependent or necessity. They're necessary jobs. So, they're driving the buses. They are working in service professions. Mm-hmm. So they're getting more exposure. Their viral load is higher. Then when they leave their jobs, they go home to high density housing. So since because of redlining, a lot of African Americans aren't available or aren't able to purchase homes in the suburbs where they have nice large yards and separated from their neighbors. They live in high density apartment complexes where, you know, the only thing that separates you from your neighbor is a 4-foot wall wide hall. So you're constantly being exposed to other individuals. And, so in your workplace and you're living in the communities that you live in and your general overall health. So those are the things that come together in the perfect storm that has resulted in African-Americans having a disproportionate representation as far as the coronavirus pandemic is concerned.
And that's called redlining?
Well, redlining is when they look in neighborhoods and they won't give loans to African-Americans who are trying to buy homes. So this actually was started in the 50s. When after the war, when they had the GI Bill and a lot of people were able to people were moving from the cities into the suburbs, and then the loans and the FBA loans and all these things that were allowing people to purchase houses weren't available to African Americans. They would put African Americans in the projects, very high density apartment complexes, which I have to state originally and initially were actually relatively decent homes. But they were just high density. And over time, you know, because there was lack of community, people would have a negative impact on that. So, you know, the homes would deteriorate, the neighborhood would deteriorate. Then you consider things like drugs and alcohol. And that's also when, a lot of the drugs became popular in the United States and in those communities. Everything from marijuana, cocaine, crack, LSD, you name it. And so it started, you know, the social determinants determine where the future of Black people will be for generations just from redlining in their social situations when they couldn't move out into the nicer areas.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's so disturbing. So do you, in your opinion, do you feel this is a form of population control?
That's absolutely a form of population control. And it was a designated effort and a determined effort by the federal government at that time to keep African Americans, quote, in their place. And so all people of color, and, you know, so a lot of immigrants, Hispanics, anybody, people of color. But the there was also a definite support for poor Caucasians to get them out of the ghetto and to uplift that race. And so a lot of people, you know, they were first generation wealth. They're now entering possibly the second generation. But home ownership is the number one determinant on whether you have any net worth or not. And Black people don't own homes. They have no net worth or minimal net worth. Caucasians own homes. So that gets
they're the biggest consumers per capita worldwide.
Exactly.
Wow. All right. So this is really good. So what questions do you suggest a patient ask a personal care provider? Most people go to the doctor and they don't know. The doctor is going on about what's going on. I'll take me for instance. I just started seeing a new chiropractor. And so, you know, just to stay aligned, overall health, my overall health is good, no meds, that sort of thing. And I'm pretty astute talking with physicians and about my health and that sort of thing. But when the doctor was talking to me and showing me my x-rays and saying, okay, this is good, we can fix this is not so good. He was very good. But for a person who doesn't really know what to ask the doctor, for instance, there were some dark spots in the in my X-ray. And when I asked what are these dark spots, he said, oh, that's just gas is trapped in the lower intestine. Mm-hmm. And it's good because you don't have a lot of it and it's just normal and da da da. But if you're looking at that, because the first thing that came to my mind was, oh my God, is it cancer? What are those dark spots? You know, while he was talking and explaining his care mm-hmm. that he was gonna do with me, I'm focused on those dark spots. And I at first fear was like, don't ask what they are, maybe he'll tell you. But then it was like, okay, what are these dark spots on this? So what kind of questions should a patient going to a personal care provider ask, no matter what the appointment?
Okay, first, you have to make sure that you are communicating with your primary care provider, and that is one of the biggest problems. The electronic medical record has depersonalized the office visit. You go through a list of questions that you check and point to before the doctor even comes in the room. You never review those questions with the doctor. He looks at them separately, and he's not going to bring them up unless you do, because he's trying to get through the day. So the reality of the matter is that the medical model that's in place right now, in order to have a successful business, you know, patients are booked for an appointment that should last how long, you think?
15 to 20 minutes.
11 minutes.
Wow.
11 minutes.
What can you find out in 11 minutes?
Exactly. You can barely get in, say hello and how you doing, but that's the model. And that's, you know, and unfortunately, the insurance companies have paced it that way. The medical establishment has paced it that way, and patients have allowed it to happen. So the first thing, you know, I tell a patient is tell the doctor to come in. They tell doctors, don't sit down, because if you sit down, you're going to prolong the conversation, and you don't control. You control the conversation when you stand up over the patient. Well, first thing I would tell my physician, have a seat. We're going to talk about this, and then do so. Clark Howard in Atlanta, who's a consumer advocate, advocates, he tells patients, write down the list of concerns that you have and make sure you go through all of them.
That's a good
common
idea.
Language in a doctor's office now is we're only going to talk about one problem, and then we'll deal with the rest of that the next time, and the next time never actually comes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is a problem. How can you talk about one? Who has one health issue? You know, right. It may be an ingrown toenail, but you also may have pain in your back, or you also may have a sore throat. You know, there are multiple things that you should not be limited as to what you can talk about by that. But again, that's what the MBAs have said the doctors need to do to take care of patients. So the doctors need to take control over taking care of patients. The patients need to respect them for the request that they get what they came for, that they're getting their health care needs addressed. So you go through your questions and you do that.
And see, that rolls into my next question. What is Big Pharma's role in the healthcare divide?
Okay, Big Pharma plays two roles. One is a positive role. Well, take for instance right now, you have 120 companies that are chasing, trying to develop a vaccine for the coronavirus. Mm-hmm. They have learned more in the last 2 months about vaccine preparation than they have in the last 30 years. Because, you know, this is almost a Manhattan-type project. This is an Apollo moon launch. They're trying to determine this. So science and technology has to have a financial basis, and Big Pharma can do that. A lot of people have the right ideas, but they just don't have the funding to bring those ideas to fruition. So Big Pharma can do that. Then on the other side, you have Big Pharma who, over the past year, have increased the cost of basic medications by 1,000%.
Wow. You know,
medications that were $20 for a 1 month supply a year ago are now $300 for no apparent reason. There's been no new research and development. They only increase the price because they can. And once they have priced themselves, particularly, let's say a patient, and you may have know people that have had this issue, diabetics who can no longer purchase their insulin. The insulin is overpriced. And, you know, again, insulin used to cost them $15, $20 for a 1 month supply. Now it's $300 or $400. Nobody can afford that. I don't care what salary you're making. And insurance companies aren't paying for it. So the patients, they come to my office, you know, in tears. Dr. Kaya, I can't afford my insulin. It's $400. Do you have any samples? No, they don't sample insulin products. So I don't have any. So I can't help you from that perspective. But I did say, I can say this, that I read in Sunday's paper that there's going to be a new program through Medicare. They're going to, a person has to pay an extra $35 per month, but they call that the insulin program, and that's going to make a few insulins available for them that's going to be covered in their program. So just the $35 a month, they're not going to get the $400 or $500 insulins, but they will get something that they will be able to cover. Because there are some phenomenal breakthroughs in the treatment of disease states now. There are medications that can control every aspect of diabetes as if you are no longer a diabetic, but nobody can afford the medications. So everybody goes back to, you know, the inexpensive generic drugs, and they may have to take five or six of them. None of them control their blood sugar, so their health deteriorates. Next thing you know, they're having amputations of their toes, then their feet, then below the knee amputation, above the knee amputation, because the disease state, which could have been very well controlled, has been, you know, how they're being treated is an economic matter, and it should never be an economic matter when you're treating patients, if there's a medication that's available, and there are.
Well, how should Americans, how should we protect ourselves against future pandemics? I mean, from a medical point of view.
Well, there's going to be another virus that always is. Oh, yeah. They come and go. Yeah. You know, it may be in 5 years, it may be in 50 years, but it will come because Mother Nature will not be defeated. So viruses will develop themselves. But we also were blessed with a phenomenal immune system that usually will respond to those types of things. A significant portion of the population may lose their lives due to a pandemic, but a more significant portion will not. They will adapt, they will acclimate, and they will be able to survive. And that's what we're doing right now with the coronavirus. In the United States, they have adopted basically the philosophy of herd immunity because nothing has changed in where we are right now. The virus is still infecting people at the same high rates, other than we've been dealing with it for a couple of months, and now all of a sudden we're going to open things up again. Nothing's going to change except people are going to get sicker.
Right.
So, you know, 80% of people will get it. They'll get over it. They won't have any long-term sequela. 10 to 15% will have a significant session, but they will get over it. But they might have some lung damage that's permanent. 5 to 10% of people will get it and die. It's just going to happen. And it's happening, you know, mostly in people over age 70. But I just had a patient, 28 years old, diagnosed on Thursday, dead on Sunday. Had no comorbid conditions, no problems otherwise, but just did not survive the coronavirus. So it happens. It happens.
It's so unfortunate. It's so sad. And I just want to thank you for being on the front line, where you are. You know, it makes me feel better knowing someone like you is out there treating people and caring about people's health.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. What role can physicians play toward universal healthcare?
Okay, the vast majority of physicians actually are proponents of universal healthcare. If they were not, they are now. A lot of physicians that closed their practices and took jobs at major hospitals in Atlanta, there are three major hospital systems, Piedmont, Emory, and WellStar. Mm-hmm. A lot of those physicians lose their jobs. I'm like, how do you lay off doctors and nurses in the middle of a health crisis?
Right. I don't get it.
Thousands of doctors because they don't want to pay their salaries. So one of the benefits of being one of the rare doctors that's still in private practice is I'm the captain of my own ship, and I'm not going to fire myself, and I'm not going to lay myself off. So a corporate decision made strictly based on funding and money is going to handicap. If we get a second wave, they won't have the healthcare infrastructure in place to take care of these people because they would have laid off all the doctors and the nurses, which is what they're doing right now.
Wow. There are no words. There are just no words. All I can say is, folks, and I'm going to say it, if you've never voted before, you can't vote, you never thought about voting, I don't know how hard you need to be hit in the head. Okay. That's all I'm going to say. Vote. Okay. Just vote. So food, let's talk about food and activities that promote health and well-being. Me, myself, I'm blessed. I'm a 56. I'm glad to say I'll be 57 September on Labor Day. I'm on no meds. I'm on, I have no health conditions, and I knock on wood, and I thank God for that. And a lot of it, I feel, is the way that I eat and how I take care of myself, or try to take care of myself. You know, I'm not perfect, mm-hmm. but I try. I'm making a good attempt. What food and activities do you feel or do you suggest that would promote health and well-being?
Okay, people ask me a question like this all the time, and I say, instead of giving you a menu, let me give you some guidelines. And my personal mantra is this, and I have people walk up to me and repeat it back to me all the time. They say, I heard you speak at this event, and you said, because people ask, Dr. Kari, what can I eat? And my response is, if it swims, you can eat it. If it flies, you can eat it. If it walks on the earth with cloven hooves, then you should not eat it or eat it in control and eat it minimally.
Okay, so that's good. I need you to repeat that. I need you, if it flies.
If it swims, you can eat it. If it flies, you can eat it.
If it walks
on the earth with cloven hooves, then you need to limit the amount that you intake or avoid eating it at all. So we all know how bad pork is for you. But, you know, beef gets a bad rep. It's not bad to eat in moderation. But some people just say, okay, I don't eat meat. I only eat chicken and fish, which would be very, very good. And then make your plate colorful. Your plate should have vegetables from everything. It should have something green. It should have something yellow. Have something orange. Not only do these usually taste good, but it also will fill your stomach up and give you less calories per ounce, so to speak, than a high-dense food like a steak. And it also will help with your digestion. So the thing is, we have seen portions grow in the United States. The size of a dinner plate has almost doubled in the last 20 years from where they were, the number of inches. And then the amount of food that we put on the plate, servings, you know, we used to have space between each entree in a plate. Now we pile it on and everything is touching, and it's just amazing as to the volume that we're taking in. When you go to a restaurant, everybody has to take home a doggy bag or takeout because it's too much food for one person to consume.
To go plate. Well, they used to say you don't eat more than
so now,
the size of your fist.
One of the things that Dolores and I would do.
Okay.
Exactly. The size of the palm of your hand. Take the fingers off and just the palm of your hand. That's a 4 to 6 ounce serving of virtually any entree. A chicken breast, a piece of steak, a piece of fish. That should be the size that you should be consuming. But most people, they're getting double fisted. You know, when the fast food restaurant started upsizing, maximizing, and supersizing, when the term supersizing came out, that was double the calories for another 20 cents, which was absolutely incredible. You would think people wouldn't eat it. And there was moderation. There was a trend toward moderation a few years ago, but now everybody's trying to see how much can we pile on a sandwich.
Right.
They're making sandwiches with French fries, onion rings, extra sauces, 3 different cheeses, all kind of craziness.
Doesn't that tie into American greed?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. People are, you know, they, and again, eating is what we do. We, you know, eating is part of our socialization. We have dinner meetings. We go out on a date. We do dinner and a movie. We socialize. Meet me at lunch. Let's have lunch together. That's so it's always usually a group function and a social function. So we have to, and this is a good example of how we don't have to do that now. As a person that usually goes to a meeting virtually every night of the week, and now I've been on a Corona lockdown, I'm learning a whole different way of life.
Isn't it great?
More time with my children. They actually see me now. But when you go to these events, there's always food. And so now, you know, even if you're having a Zoom meeting, you know, you're eating in moderation or you're not eating at all. Whereas if you go to a location or a restaurant to eat, you're going to have food as a part of the evening. So, so you're adjusting that lifestyle. I think we're going to see some adjustments in lifestyle. And after people, you know, the first 3 to 4 weeks of the lockdown, people were eating to excess, drinking to excess, and doing no exercise. They were just sitting down Netflix and chilling.
The COVID-15.
COVID-15. Then they learned, they say, maybe, you know, I'm tired of this. I'm getting fanny fatigue. I need to get up and move. So people now, I see more people walking my neighborhood than I have since I've lived there. And that's been 20 years.
People actually live in your neighborhood.
Yes. So that's where we are with that.
So Dr. Collier, how can longevity be promoted today?
Okay, longevity is and live a life. Everybody wants to live a long life. I tell you, everybody wants to live. When I start off my health and wellness talks with that question, how many people want to live a long life? Raise your hand. Somebody doesn't raise their hand, I'm trying to figure out what's going on. Exactly. So I say, everybody wants to go to heaven. They just don't want to go right now. So, you know, they want to have a long, but longevity is not necessarily your only objective. Long life and good health.
Good
because
health.
If you are living a long time, but you are blind, you can't
right.
walk, don't have
right.
control over your bowel and bladder. Not only are you
right.
a burden on whoever your caregivers are, usually a spouse or the oldest daughter in the family, but you're not enjoying life. You know, mm-hmm. people are just, you're just miserable when all you're doing is eating and breathing and laying there.
Taking up space.
So you want to make, you want to be what I call Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. You want to still look good. You want to be dancing and you want to, you know, still be dressing up and enjoying life. You know, even though
right.
you may be older. So either, find some activity that brings you pleasure that you will continue to do. Going to the gym is work for some people. They call it work out. People say,
right.
I have to force myself to go to the gym. Well, if you don't like it, then don't do that.
Don't do
find
it.
Another
and
activity.
And the gym,
you know,
sorry,
dancing
you
is one that everybody
it.
Seems to like. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know,
yeah.
so physical activity, 30 minutes, 3 to 4 times per week will provide longevity. If mm-hmm. you have a chronic disease, such as high blood pressure, high cholesterol, or diabetes, and you're on medication, guess what? Take your medicine the way that you're supposed to take your medicine. I cannot tell you the number of people say, well, I didn't take my blood pressure medicine today. Why not? I didn't feel like I needed it. I didn't feel like my blood pressure was up. And you know, there's no feeling like my blood pressure is up. When you feel like it's up, you really are in danger. I say, you can feel ready, your blood pressure be off the chart. You can feel horrible and your blood pressure be perfectly normal. The thing, there's no correlation between how you feel and what level you're at. So it's important to take the medication every day. And once you have a disease state under control, it's much easier to keep it under control than it is to lose control and then try to recapture control. Every time you lose control, it's more difficult and harder to get back to a controlled circumstance.
And that
so
makes
just
sense.
Take the medications. I tell people, if you do half the things I ask you to do, you'll live a long, good life. If you do everything I ask you to do, you'll add 10 years to your life, quality, with no Alzheimer's.
I have to say, I'm a patient of yours, and I did everything you've always told me to do. And so look at me now. I'm just great. Life is good. Life
you
is
look
good.
Fantastic.
So,
is this what 50-something looks like? I mean, amazing. No diagnosis, no medication. That's great.
I know. My doctor here in Savannah says I'm an anomaly.
You are, particularly
so
in Savannah.
I know, right? So are you taking new patients, or how could a new patient or potential patient get in contact with your...
Yes, I'm taking new patients all day, every day. I never turn down patients. Patients just say, I heard you on this radio show. And, you know, and we'll get them in as quickly as possible. We take, of course, we still take Medicaid and Medicare. So a lot of physicians don't take, particularly Medicaid, we do. And then, you know, but the other insurances, it just matters. You know, you have to check and see. Because, you know, so many in the past, I could say, well, yeah, we take Blue Cross Blue Shield. But now they have 30 different plans. And I may be on 10 of them. I may be on 30 of them. It just depends. So, but, you know, don't let the financial issue be a concern if you want to get good health care.
Right.
But, you know, if it is, if you have a chronic condition and you know you're going to have to spend some quality time with the doctor, then you find a doctor that's in your plan, because it will cost you money that you like. And if you don't like them and you can't fix the relationship, sometimes it's just not a good match. You know, if you like to talk and they're quiet and stoic and they keep their head buried into the laptop while they're talking to you, that's not who you want as your healthcare provider.
Right, exactly. It has to be a good fit.
This is WRUULP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings Community Radio with Global Soul.
WRUU 107.5 FM is a new and different listener-supported and all-volunteer community radio station for Savannah. Our diverse broadcast and web programming is supported by generous listeners who value our passion and spunk. We are independent of other media and receive no government or large corporate support. People like you are the largest and most important source of our funding. Go to WRUU.org to find out how you can make a one-time or monthly contribution. Thank you.
This is a message from the Georgia State Department of Public Health. Social distancing means minimizing contact with people. It also means that if you are near someone in public, try to stay at least 6 feet away. The less contact people have with one another means the less opportunity for the virus to spread. Slowing the spread of the virus means that we can keep our healthcare system from becoming overwhelmed. More information can be found at dph.georgia.gov. Now you have a chance to support both Savannah Independent Artists and WRUU during this shelter-in-place order to stop the spread of COVID-19. Creatives in Need is a group of independent artists hosted by the Roots Up Gallery, which is collaborating with WRUU during this shelter-in-place to offer an online art gallery at www.rootsupgallery.com. For every work of art sold at this online gallery, the artists receive 80% from the sales and 20% goes to WRUU and its programs like Art on the Air. Interested listeners can go to www.rootsupgallery.com to start shopping today. Family Promise of Effingham County, an organization that provides a place to stay for homeless families, is conducting an Adopt a Room fundraiser. This Adopt a Room fundraiser is seeking people who would like to donate to upgrade a room at the Family Promise House. For more information on this fundraiser, visit www.effinghamfamilypromise.org or call 912-519-0567.
Thank you so much for joining Evie Williamson with the Art of Health and Wellness. I'm so glad you're here today. I hope everybody's doing well. Let's look at Eastern versus Western medicine. You know, there's a lot of controversy about Eastern, Western medicine. Is there a happy medium?
There is a happy medium, and most scientists have appreciated some of the teachings and things they've learned about Eastern medicine, such as, let's say, acupuncture for the treatment of pain, cupping, various herbs and things that have been used by Chinese physicians for centuries. Yeah. And it's like, let's use, for instance, in the coronavirus situation that people are using and advocating hydroxychloroquine. That came from the East. And I tell you, you think they just, you know, said, well, let's use this for no apparent reason. There is a reason that they are saying use that medication because they have utilized it and it has worked. And, so then they share that information with other scientists in the West. And because it didn't originate in the West, the scientists will sometimes poo-poo it and say, oh, no, we need to do, double-blind control studies before we use that. And so in a lot of situations here in the United States, we are so far behind in breakthroughs in medicine because we don't listen and we're not willing to accept science from other countries. We want to either repeat the science ourselves or we just disavow it until it's so overwhelming that we have to accept it because it's malpractice not to. So, but I have to say, every generation of physicians is becoming more open to Eastern philosophies and Eastern medicines versus, say, 30 years ago. Internet is a great information tool because people, they'll read it on the internet, and now that gives it some validity at least, and then they're willing to learn. But there are many cases of doctors that will go to the East and train, do a year or so over there, learn various techniques of things like acupuncture and become proficient in it and integrate that into their traditional Western style practice.
Now, your clinic is a teaching clinic, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
And so how are your residents chosen? How do you handpick them? Does a school send you folks? How does that happen?
All of the above. I handpick them. The school sends them. They hear about me and decide they want to come, and they'll come in the interview. And because I don't just accept them, I say, you have to come to my office and let me meet you. And I want it to be a good fit. And then I have to make sure that you're willing to learn because oftentimes they aren't. And, particularly this new generation of, they're so caught up in electronics. They want to look up everything. And so I ask them a question. Everybody bends their head down and start Googling on their cell phone. I say, oh my God, what happens if the battery on your phone dies? I guess the patient dies too. Because you don't have a basic knowledge acumen. You can find the information, but you don't know it, and you have to know it. You have to be able to think on your feet because oftentimes you won't have access to an electronic device And even so, that information there may not be correct.
Yeah.
So you need to learn that. So there were even residency programs that were trying to go fully electronic, and they quickly learned that their residents knew nothing, and so they had to they changed away from that. Now it's being reintegrated slowly, but in a controlled fashion, and they're giving the students an opportunity to demonstrate that they do have a working knowledge of things versus just constantly having to look things up on the internet.
Well, Dr. Call, you've been so successful in your medical career. I have to ask you, have you groomed the next Collier generation to walk in your footsteps?
Unfortunately not. I have so many students that I have raised and quote, taught them the right way to practice medicine, if you will, or a what I consider the right way. But no one in the family. I have at least three children who definitely are smart enough to do it and could do it, but they always respond and say, you work too hard, and I can't argue with that, because I do. They see me leave early, come home late, and know that I've had an exhausting day, and they see calls in the middle of the night and calls on the weekend, and they say, and they these younger people, they don't want that lifestyle.
Right.
They'd rather do something easy from home on the computer, and have a earn more money than I do, and have a better lifestyle. And so, in the past, I would argue vehemently about that, but now I'm starting to think about it and say, well, maybe they're right.
Exactly.
When I see a 20 something, that's making $500,000 a year, working 3 hours a day.
right. 2 days a week.
Two days a week. Yeah. So, so it's some validity to that, but this is a calling, and you don't do it for the money.
Right.
You do it because you want to serve the community, and so that being the case, you have to have the calling. My youngest daughter, Catherine, just upped and decided she wanted to be a neurosurgeon, and she's very brainy. She likes to say, "I'm the smartest person in the room." And I say, "Well, if you're going to think you're the smartest person in the room, you have to actually be the smartest person."
So you have to start
doing the work, and now the work is becoming challenging. And so I'm hoping that she will stick to it, but I'm not sure that she will. She could, like I said, she has the brain power. It's the willpower that I'm concerned about.
Wow. Well, you know what? My money's on her. It's hard to believe that she's studying neural medicine. That ages us. That dates us. I remember
that
when
does.
She
was
born.
That does.
But, that's a wonderful thing. So, Dr. Collier, what's your position on vaccines? There's a lot of controversy. Should we? Should we not? It's a scary thing.
Let's remove the controversy. We should. This information or misinformation campaign that's going on the internet right now is just absolutely amazing. And it's getting people to not want to take vaccines. But the vaccine, the public health use of vaccine has been the number one thing, bar none, that has established good health in the United States of America and around the world. When they first came up with the polio vaccine and started a regular vaccine regimen for individuals, it changed the health of children. They get through childhood. You don't have the childhood diseases that people used to have, measles, mumps, rubella, and they forget that children would die from measles all the time. Most people survived the chicken pox. That wasn't a problem. But deforming diseases such as polio, et cetera. So I'm a strong believer in vaccines. Now, there are some vaccines that I don't necessarily endorse, those that I would consider optional vaccines. But the meningitis vaccine has been a godsend for students that are entering college. They all have to get meningitis vaccines now.
Mm-hmm.
The hepatitis vaccine has been incredible. So again, the usual childhood vaccines, the measles, mumps, rubella, the tetanus vaccine, the tetanus shot, and so all of them. But vaccines for, prevention of possible STD-related cancers and things like that, that's a bit much. When the shingles vaccine was first developed, they said, well, if you've had shingles before, you don't need it because you've already had it, so you have antibodies, which is absolutely correct. Then they started saying, well, if you had shingles, you might want to take the shingles vaccine anyway. Then they had one dose of shingles vaccine. Now they have two doses of shingles vaccine. So the question is that literally, truly based on science, or is it, selling vaccines?
That's why I've always said medicine is a practice.
It is.
Not an exact science. That's why they practice medicine.
That's why they practice medicine. And you hopefully will be practicing for all your life. If, when you think you know it all, you learn that you know nothing.
That you don't, right? Yeah. So how can we hear your, I mean, you're on all these stations, the Hip Hop Doctor, Your Health is Important, all these syndicated shows. How can we hear your weekly broadcast? Where can someone tune in?
Okay, well, now I do daily broadcasts on the syndicated Ricky Smiley Morning Show. So we are the number one syndicated radio show in the country.
I saw that.
And there will be there won't be another one because your radio is changing. Everybody's iPodding and getting their music from other sources. So right now we're in a sweet spot as far as syndication is concerned. And I literally have, my largest audiences are in places that I've never even been before. But people will call and say, "Oh, I heard you in Texas. I heard you in Cincinnati. I heard you in St. Louis." I get calls all the time. And so when I do the radio broadcast, it's talk radio and call in. So people can call. And now with the internet, as a matter of this morning, when I finished my segment, within 5 minutes, I was receiving phone calls on my personal cell phone. Now, of course, I don't give my cell phone number out.
Right.
But people find it. I don't know how.
Yeah.
This new technology, they find it and they use it. And I don't mind. They're shocked when I answer the phone and I speak to them. They think I'm going to lambast them for calling me, but I don't.
You are the black version of Dr. Gupta. Sanjay
Gupta has my job.
Right. There you go. That's a great way to look at it. This is so great. So, this has really, really been great. And again, please definitely consult a licensed medical physician about any healthcare information and or advice that's been given on this program. This is Evie Williamson, WRUU, Art of Health and Wellness. Been doing this since January, kind of fell in my lap. So I'm excited. And I'm excited about our listeners, and I'm excited about the quality of guests that we have on the show. So Dr. Collier, tell me something I don't know when it comes to internal medicine, health and wellness. Tell me something I don't know.
Okay. Something that you don't know. Well, you know so much, EL. It's difficult to say that. Let's say this. If a person has a diagnosis of high blood pressure, you oftentimes hear people say, "The doctor has me on all these medications. I want to come off some of this medication." Well, the average person requires from 3 to 5 medications to control just their blood pressure. So, and triple therapy or oral therapy, there are 4 classes of drugs for diabetes. So let's say a person has high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, and high lipids, high triglycerides. So they're on 3 to 5 medicines for their blood pressure. They're on 3 medicines minimum for their diabetes. They're on 2 for their cholesterol. They're on 1 for arthritis. They're taking vitamins, et cetera. So it's not unusual for an individual that has those disease processes to really require anywhere from 10 to 15 medications per day. All perfectly legitimate, all perfectly reasonable, all perfectly compatible and necessary. Because, I will oftentimes have, someone bring in their mother, the grandmother. "That doctor has my mother on all these medications. She couldn't need all this. You need to take them off of that." And then when I look at them, each one is perfectly and appropriately prescribed and indicated and necessary. So, again, it requires sometimes the doctor just has not communicated with you effectively what you're taking and why you're taking it and the need to continue to take it. And so I always try to make sure that I do that, and I hope I do a good job in letting my patients know why they're on these medications. I spend a lot of quality time typing out information for them that is beyond just the regular labels, etc., so they can understand. And I do talk to people and take time. But okay, so if you come to my office and your appointment is at 10 o'clock and now it's 11 and I haven't seen you yet, that's why. Because I spend quality time. I don't rush anybody through an appointment. And I tell people, when you are in a position that you need that extra time, you're going to get it as well. And everybody wants the extra time. They just don't want anybody else to get it.
Right.
They all want, the quality time to do that. So, every day, all day, it's a balancing act, trying to, spend as much time as I can with individuals, and give them as much information as I can. Because being, a physician, I tell you, I could war a room of 1,000 doctors with large Latin words and really talk eloquently and speak like a scientist. But if you don't understand what I'm saying, it's going to waste a visit for both of us. So we have to make sure that we are not, that we're communicating effectively. So, you know, patients will say, well, I went to Dr. So-and-so and saw him. I said, well, what did he tell you? Nothing. I said, well, no, I know he told you something, but what it is, the person didn't hear or didn't understand what he said. So, again, it's very important that the person understands, and I always close my business out with, one, is there any question I wasn't smart enough to ask you that you were concerned about? And that will always result in at least one additional question. And then others, do you understand what we've talked about today? Do you understand what your medications are? And I tell people, don't tell me I'm taking the blue pill and I'm taking the yellow pill for this. I say, you need to know the names of your medications. You need to know why you're taking them or what they treat, and learn to pronounce them correctly. I say, this is not complicated. But medicine is a different language. It's just like trying to speak Spanish to someone who only speaks English, or vice versa. So you have to make sure that you're not, assuming that the person has a baseline medical acumen, because most people don't. This is a whole nother language for them. And doctors talk fast and they talk quick and they get you in and out. And, you get to the pharmacy and there are pre-printed labels for your medications. So I will spend on my prescription, say, please take this one time per day or three times per day to control your blood pressure and lower this and that. None of that makes it to the label. The label has been pre-printed. It just says take three times a day. Doesn't tell you what it's for, how you take it, whatever, you know. So it's horrible that happens. So therefore, I will type out a guideline and I'll make one copy that's small enough to put in your pocket. And I tell you, put the other copy on your refrigerator so you don't have to look for it. So you'll always know what you're taking, why you're taking it, and what it's for. So if somebody asks you, if you're sick or if you're at the, you know, the hospital or you're in the emergency room, they say, well, what do you take? You say, oh, I don't know. And the final thing that I tell people is take a picture of your prescription bottle. Make sure you can read the label so that if somebody asks you what you're taking, if you can't pronounce it or you can't remember, you keep a scroll on your cell phone, because everybody's using that. They take cell phone pictures. So, and that would be a quick way to figure out what you're taking. I said, you don't even have to take the time to type it out. Just take a picture of the bottle. Just make sure that you can read the label in the picture.
And that is excellent, excellent advice. And on that note, we're going to wrap it up. Dr. Collier, thank you so much for being my guest. I'm definitely going to have you back on the show.
I look forward to it, Evie.
Absolutely, absolutely. Tell Dolores and everybody I say hello.
I shall.
You are so appreciated. Again, this is The Art of Health and Wellness with Evie Williamson, WRUU 107.5, Savannah Community Radio with Global Soul. So, folks, definitely tune in next week, same time, same place, 2 to 3, WRUU.org. And everybody, please make it a safe day.